essential Judaism is basically everything about Judaism in very simple, bite-sized, clear ways. If someone says, you know, Shmini Atzeret, and you have no idea what it is, you look up in essential Judaism and he'll give you in a paragraph or two what you need to know about it. It's like Telushkin's Jewish Literacy. Those are the two best tell me stuff about Judaism I don't know books that there are. Essential Judaism is actually, I think it's organized a little better, although Telushkin's has probably more inspirational uplift. And he also has one called The Essential Torah, which tells you everything about the Bible that you would like to know. So if somebody mentions, you know, the book of Ecclesiastes, and you have no idea what that is, and you want a quick, clear explanation, you can look up in Robinson's Essential Torah. The reason that I brought this today and what I want to do today is explained by the fact that I just finished a book that I don't recommend you read. Because I had read Michael Fishbane is a professor of Jewish studies at the University of Chicago. Brilliant guy. Wrote the definitive work, and it is definitive and amazing, about how the Bible comments on itself. That is, different allusions in different parts of the Bible, how one book of the Bible says something about the other book of the Bible. And it's a dense, learned work that you have to study. Then he wrote a book called, a series of lectures called The Kiss of God, which talks about the Jewish attitude towards the moment of death and how God is involved in that moment of death. It's also not a breezy read. It's a scholarly book, but it was fascinating and intricate and well done. So he wrote this book called Sacred Attunement. And I always appreciated his work, so I bought it and I read it, but it is impossible to read. I mean, it's just impossible to read. I could read you a sample sentence, but it's like, okay, I'll pick any sentence. That's not too short. Here's a sample paragraph. Cultures grow along these pathways, and every achievement is a triumph of the human spirit. But the vastness remains, always eluding our syntax and mental vigor. And this truth must be borne in mind, lest the little victories of human imagination become a mask of self-delusion. We may have faith in our use of names for God and things, but we must remember that they've been wrought from unfathomable unboundedness for human use, and thus don't reflect ultimate truth. To forget this is folly. I'm sure it is, but I don't know. Now that was, I have to say, that was more intelligible than put differently, theology seeks to cultivate an abiding consciousness of God's informing presence in all the realities of existence, the infinite modalities of the divine effectivity. I'm sure that's true. So, in fact, Gordon Tucker, who was my teacher at the rabbinical school, and then I became his research assistant, as a colleague, is a brilliant guy, has a PhD in philosophy from Princeton, I believe. And he wrote a review of this in the foreword, and he said that he read it twice. And I wrote him an email, and the title of the email was "What I Admire About You," and the email was that you read this twice. I said, I read it once, but I felt about this what someone once said about Wagner's music, which is, it can't be judged on one hearing, and I have no intention of listening to it again. So, all right, having said all that, I mean, Fishbane's written some wonderful things, but this really is impenetrable. Now, I got a good deal out of it, but I paid very close attention, and certain parts I just said, I'm sure he's saying something important, but life is limited, and I can't. I'm telling you the truth. So I read the whole book, but really, a lot of it, I felt like I skimmed the surface. However, having said all that, there is a part where he talks about the Joseph story in the ladder, and he applies the four classical methods of interpreting the Jacob story in the ladder, interpreting the Torah called Pardes. And he goes through them. And I realized that we had never discussed those methods. And now that we had an opportunity to have Fishbane lead us through those four, and this will be, the part will be clear to you, that we ought to go over what the Pardes is. And so I looked around for an explanation. I was looking for a briefer one, but this will do. Let me give you the background, and then we can look at Robinson, and then if we get to it today, we'll look at how Fishbane applies Pardes. First of all, the word pardes itself means, as you can hear, it has echoes of paradise, right? There is a famous rabbinic story, Arba'an Nichnasu LePardes, four entered essentially the mystical palace, okay? Only one of these are four rabbis. One of them becomes an apostate, one of them goes mad. Only one emerges whole, and that's Rabbi Akiva. But the idea is that Pardes is some mystical paradise that the rabbis write about a lot, but that word of Pardes was then applied to how you're supposed to interpret the Torah. Okay? Four categories of interpreting the Torah for Pardes. Okay? P stands for Pshat. Resh, or R, stands for Remez. All of these are going to be in here, so you don't have to write them down, which means hints. Okay? Dalid is for a drash, in other words, midrash, and samach is for sod, which means secret, in other words, mystical stuff. Now, here, would you pass these back? Some people didn't get the sheet, so if you didn't get the sheet, there are some more. All right, now, these are four different ways that the rabbis apply interpretation to the same, and if you have extras, please give it to whoever's has come in late or whoever has not come in yet. Or as people are walking, I guess you can't give it to someone who hasn't come in yet. So that's the mystical interpretation. So what I want to do is go through a quick one and then we'll look at his interpretation. So Pshat, for example, is in the beginning God created the heaven and earth. The Pshat is in the beginning of everything God creates the heaven and earth. Okay? That's the simple meaning. And look at Robinson, Pshat. The most basic way of reading the Bible is for its plain sense. Do you see where that is?
Yeah.
Meaning. The meaning that's inherent in the text as we have it. Pshat draws on the passage, its grammar, philology, that's the study of language, right? Historical content. All of that is the Pshat. We're just trying to find out what did the author mean when he wrote these words. For example, Ed Greenstein, who's a professor of Bible, draws on Rashi and his grandson Rashbam to show the distinction between a homiletical and a plain sense reading. Genesis 49:7, Jacob says he'll divide his sons Shimon and Levi and scatter them in Israel. All right, that's the verse. I will divide you and scatter you in Israel. Jacob says that to Shimon and Levi. Rashi writes, I'll separate this one from that one, so Levi won't be in the number of the tribes, as indeed they're dispersed among the tribes. Okay? He believes that Jacob is punishing them for having banded together to do evil in the wake of the rape of Dinah and needs to separate them. Okay. By contrast, Rashbam sees the passage in its most literal historical context. Levi was dispersed among the 12 tribes, as it's written in Joshua. In other words, that's the historical outcome that befell the tribe of Levi, and that's all there is to it. Those are two different ways of reading the Pshat. What did the author intend? He intended Jacob to be saying, Levi won't be with the other tribes, okay? It's a fairly simple, straightforward reading of what Jacob means when he says, I'm going to separate Shimon and Levi. It means Levi will be separate from all the other tribes. Remember, Levi doesn't have a territory. The Levites don't have a territory. They're intermixed with all the other tribes, so they're scattered. Okay, now let's look. Pshat readings also, right, are broad enough, this is the last paragraph, to encompass metaphorical and figurative language. Exodus says it'll be a sign on your arm and remembrance between your eyes, right? The rabbis think the pshat of that is tefillin. Why? Because if the Bible's talking about a sign on your arm and something between your eyes, then you got to figure out what's a sign on your arm and between your eyes. So that means tefillin, okay? That's how you figure out the pshat of a verse. You try to see the context, the history, the language, the simple meaning. With me so far? Okay, now we go to drash. It's true that if you go pardes, then remez comes before drash, right? Par, resh, des. But drash is a sort of lower level of interpretation, as you'll see, so people usually put drash next. To seek, okay? Drash is midrash. All these homiletical, all these sort of sermonic things. The example he gives is when the Egyptians cross the Red Sea and the sea closes in on them, the drash is that the angels were singing and God said, how dare you sing while my creatures are drowning, right? You may get that from a hint in the verse, But clearly, there's nothing in the Bible about angels. There's nothing in the Bible about angels singing. There's nothing in the Bible about God getting angry. It's drash. It fills in stuff. When we say, for example, I'll give you a beautiful drash that my father gave. When Jacob and Esau find each other after years, and Esau was going to kill Jacob, but in fact, he falls on his neck and cries. So my father developed a beautiful drasha. The reason that happened was because it was the ancient world. People didn't normally look at themselves. Esau looks at Jacob, and because Jacob is his twin, even though they're not identical, they're the same age, he sees how old Jacob has gotten. He realizes how many years have passed, how old he is, so they cry instead. That's a drash, okay? Can you pass this back? Okay. She's moving on the side. We have a sheet for you. There's two left. So anybody who doesn't have one, please take those last two. Okay. So that's drash. All right. And drash is something we've done again and again and again in this class, and so you're familiar with. Now turn the page over for remez. Remez is the Hebrew for hint. And as a method of Torah interpretation, it seeks the allegorical meaning of the text, focusing on philosophical implications. The most obvious example of such a reading would be the statement by Talmudic sages that the Song of Songs is in reality a relationship between the people Israel and Adonai, rather than the highly erotic love song it appears to be. Okay? That's philosophical and it's allegorical. Allegory means when someone, a character, stands for an idea as opposed to standing for a character. Okay? It's not that they're no longer characters, but they stand for an idea. So an allegory is when a common allegory would be. A lot of fairy tales work as allegories too. You can say, for example, that the story of Little Red Riding Hood and the Big Bad Wolf is an allegory, right? The Big Bad Wolf represents maybe male sexuality. The Big Bad Wolf might represent human violence. All those things, but the point is, if you see the wolf operating that way, that's remez, that's allegory, that's philosophy, okay? And then sod, this is the toughest one. This is the Kabbalistic meaning, the mystical meaning, all right? So there's a strong strain of mysticism in Judaism, best exemplified by Kabbalah, the mystical movement that arose in the 12th century. Let's go to the second paragraph. Central to Jewish mysticism is the idea that truth cannot be expressed solely in words. Words can only denote that which is perceived by the intellect and the senses. Truth, on the contrary, is beyond human sensory perception and cognition. It can't be expressed by mere human language. The Bible's written in human language, but it's divinely inspired. Therefore, the mystics reason the words contain divine truth, but not when read the way that humans normally read them. In some way, the divine words must symbolize truth beyond words. Reading for denotation and connotation, that is, for what the words say and mean, will not uncover that truth. Instead, the mystics read the Bible as a code book, a dictionary of symbols to be deciphered by methods such as gematria and notarikon. As one mystical text puts it, many lights shine forth from each word and each letter. Sod, literally mystery or secret, is the method of biblical interpretation that searches for mystical significance, and it became a special province of the Kabbalists, who more than any other school of Jewish mysticism focused their attention on interpretation of texts, called hermeneutics, but you can avoid the word. We've already touched briefly on gematria in chapter 4. Applied to reading the Torah, now we're on the last column, it can be used to ferret out such meanings. For example, the word yihyeh is composed of two yuds, which has the numerical value of 10, and two heys, each with the value of 5, right? In Numbers 6:5, a passage that tells you the ritual obligations of the Nazarite, who's taken a vow of asceticism in service to God, the phrase kadosh yihyeh, he shall be holy, is interpreted as the reason the Nazarite's vows last for 30 days, because yud hey vav hey equals 30, therefore the Nazarite's vows last for 30 days. Okay, this is very common. Chai is 18, that's the most commonly known one, right? And the reason, by the way, that you get gematria in Hebrew is less implausible than it sounds. You have to have gematria in Hebrew, because we think of numbers as being represented by Arabic numerals, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. But in ancient Israel, there were no Arabic numerals. If you wanted to say 8, you said chet. So when you read the word chai, it would be natural that you would think 18 and alive at the same time, because every word was actually a number too. So when the mystics read the Torah, they're looking for all these numerical correspondences. And let me tell you, it gets incredibly ingenious and complicated. And if you don't believe it, implausible. But if you do, then you can find very, like emet, the word for truth in Hebrew. The aleph is the first letter in the alphabet, mem is the exact middle letter of the alphabet, and taf is the last letter of the alphabet. So truth covers the beginning, the middle, and the end, right? There are lots and lots of them like that. They're quite impressive when you start putting the computers to work. Okay. Another method of interpretation designed to reveal hidden meanings is that of notaricon, a word derived from the Latin notarius, or shorthand writer. There are two types. In the first, a word is understood as an acronym for its literal meaning. For example, the first word of the Ten Commandments, Anochi, is an abbreviation for Ana Nafshi Ketavit Yahavit, I myself wrote and gave them, right? So there's no doubt that the Ten Commandments, that's the Decalogue, is the word of the Almighty. In the second type of notaricon, a word may be broken up into other words. For example, the name Reuven becomes Reu-ven, see the sun. Okay? Gershom Scholem, the great historian of Jewish mysticism, wryly observes, explication of the level of sod had limitless possibilities. Okay? So that's the level of sod. We don't need to go into the rest of it. Now that we've looked at the four levels of interpretation of the Torah, let's go back to the story of Jacob's ladder and how Fishbane applies those four levels so that we can see some of the riches in it. You will find it in chapter 29. And here it is. Okay, we're starting with Pshat now. The simple meaning of the story. We're going to start with Vayifgaba Makom is verse 11. Okay, verse 10. Start with verse 10. Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. Okay? Everybody with me there?
Yep.
All right. Now remember, in chapter 28, verse 10. Yes, 28. If anybody said 29, it was, yes. It was to test you. So chapter 28, verse 10. I can't deny that I said things now because we taped the class. So, by the way, I recommend in your marriages. You never said that. Would you roll the tape, please? Can you imagine? Like you have in the right football that you would have instant replay. All right. It's what... I'm trying to remember who said that. It may have been Shaw, but he said, if men and women really knew what they thought about each other, the world wouldn't last for 10 minutes or something along those lines. So, but of course that's not true for us. But all right. Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. Now, remember that you use every resource to understand what the text literally means. So you have to use the Hebrew wording. The beginning of the 11th verse says, Vayifga Bamakom, which they translate as he came upon a certain place. That's the colloquial translation, right? But that's not actually how the Hebrew reads it. Vayifga. Paga in Hebrew means to hit or to hurt something. There's in fact a flower that has thorns that in Hebrew is called an altigabi, don't touch me, right? Because touching, or in this case, implies something bad or hurtful. Okay. Normally, the verb paga indicates something hurtful or injurious, as the encounter vayifga bo vayamot in Kings 2:25. You don't have to look, but the point is you always interpret words in the Bible by the way they're used elsewhere. Vayifga bo vayamot, he hit upon him and he died. Okay, so the interpreter who's trying to figure out what vayifga means looks at other instances of the same word to try to figure out the pshat. What is the author saying here? But what could such an engagement or smiting mean here? Surely Jacob was peaceful, a man of tents. Remember, we learned that about him. He was an Ish Ohalim, a sage according to the rabbinic tradition. And it was Esau who was violent. So we might find a hint as to what it means in the next word, Bamakom. At first glance, this too is odd. After all, Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran, but he didn't arrive there, right? He's not at Haran yet. So what does it mean that he came to the place without any further specification? It doesn't say what place he came to. It just says Jacob came to the place. We would have expected an expression like El Makom Echad. He came to some place, not he came to the place. All right, so the place that we know of Makom is with Abraham, because Abraham comes to a Makom. He raises his eyes and sees the Makom where he's going to sacrifice Isaac. What happens when you see a Makom and it doesn't have any specification? You immediately think of Makom as being God, because that's a euphemism for God in Hebrew, is the place, because the world is God's place. So Abraham raised his eyes and saw God, the one who'd asked him to do this in the first place. Surely Makom could have a religious meaning here as well. If so, then Jacob could have engaged God through a spiritual act, such as prayer. Just such a supposition could be proved by linking Vayifga to its usage in Ruth 1:16. In Ruth 1:16, the word means something like entreat on my behalf. Will you ask on my behalf? And in fact, if you want to, we can look at Ruth. You don't have to turn to Ruth, but I'll turn to Ruth for you and get you the context. The beginning of the book of Ruth in the first chapter reads as follows. It says in 1:16, Naomi replied, "Return back, my daughters." They broke into weeping again. And Orpah, which is, by the way, if you don't know how Oprah Winfrey got her name, her mother mistook the name Orpah in the book of Ruth. That's true. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law farewell, but Ruth clung to her. So she said, "See, your sister-in-law has returned to her people and her gods. Go follow your sister-in-law." And Ruth said, "Al tifki'i bi, don't urge me to leave you." Okay? In other words, it's an urging or a pleading. So now we have Jacob pleaded the place, which isn't what we thought of at first. We thought Jacob came to someplace, but now it's Jacob all of a sudden is pleading to God, and that's where we got the tradition that Jacob here has instituted the afternoon prayer, okay? I mean, the evening prayer. This is what Jacob did. He was praying. Ve'yifga b'makom means he entreated the place. He prayed to God. Now, all of that seems implausible, but it's pshat. You just have to know how the words are used elsewhere, and then you can see why the rabbis might think that that's what it meant. Thus, one might infer that Jacob was involved in an act of divine treaty while fleeing from his brother and hoping for safe passage to Haran. Okay, let's see. I'm going to skip some of this. All right. Reading the passage in a straightforward manner, the passage being he had a dream, verse 12. He had a dream. A stairway was set on the ground, its top reached in the sky, and the angels of God were going up and down it. Reading the passage in a straightforward manner, we might have a fragment of a dream sequence, fantastic to be sure, but comprehensible. But is this all? If it's a divinely inspired dream, and if Jacob, soon to be renamed Israel, is the future father of his people, isn't it conceivable that the imagery refers to him and his adventures? So the angels going up and down suggest his own journeys to and fro. Is there any hint of what will happen in the future? Is it possible that Scripture is silent about this? What is one to do? And he dreamed. Now he brings how the rabbis interpret this dream, okay? And what you will hear is when the rabbis interpret on what they consider a pshat level, they do it by connecting this verse to other verses. No verse in the Bible for the rabbi stands alone. And he dreamed now a stairway. So they think, where do we know a stairway from in the Bible? And the place that they know someone ascending and descending, what mental image comes to them immediately? They only know one place where people ascended and descended, the ramp to the temple, where the priests would go up, dressed like angels in their garb, and they would come down. So they said, and he dreamed now a stairway. This refers to the ramp upon which the priest would ascend and set mutzav on the ground, right? Because the ladder, it says, is mutzav arza, is set on the ground. This refers to the altar, as it says, you shall make an altar of earth for me, an altar that's set on the ground. That's Exodus 20, 21. I'm not going to continually flip back and forth and read you all the verses that will prolong this longer than it needs to be. And its top reached the heavens. This refers to the sacrifices whose aroma ascended to heaven. And now the angels of God, this refers to the high priests, would go up and down because they would ascend and descend the altar. And now it says the Lord was standing nitzav upon it, right? It says that the angels were standing on the ladder. As scripture says elsewhere, I saw the Lord standing nitzav on the altar, and that's from Amos, the prophet Amos 9:1. So they've connected now Jacob seeing the ladder with the future temple and the angels with the priests, and all of this is on some level pshat because they have verbal connections. And they assume that if the Bible uses a word one place, it's deliberately, like a good author, using the same word somewhere else. So clearly it was intended. Okay? And all of a sudden, Jacob's dream is not about angels on the ladder anymore. It's about priests in the temple. Okay. Or perhaps these correlations miss the point. If so, listen to how the rabbis give a different interpretation. Also, they think, pshat. And he dreamed a stairway. This refers to where else do people go up and is up and down a place. Now they're talking about it being Sinai. Okay? And he dreamed a stairway. One second. Okay. Oops. One second. I missed one thing. All right. That's not a big deal. We'll let it go. And he dreamed a stairway. This refers to Sinai. It was set mutzav on the ground. This alludes to the gathering of people there, as it says in Scripture, and they stood vayit yatzvu at the base of the mountain. Again, mutzav and vayit yatzvu, same root. And its top reached the heaven, hashamayim. As it says elsewhere, the mountain was consumed with fire up to the heart of heaven, hashamayim. It says that in Deuteronomy. And now the angels of God, this refers now, who went up and down the mountain?
Moses
and Aaron. Because it's plural, angels. You got to get someone else in there, right? Angels of God, Moses and Aaron. We're ascending, Olim, and Moses ascended, Allah, and Yordim, and Moses went down, Vayere. And God was standing, Nitzav Alav, as scripture says, that God descended Al Har Sinai. Al and Alav are. Now, you see that they've moved now from pshat, from the simple word, to drash, okay? Because they've completely taken the use of the same words in the Bible, they've completely taken one scene and made it about another. So pshat and drash sort of start to intermix. The pshat is that Jacob has a dream, but once you look at the words, the pshat starts to waver in the same way that almost anything that you describe is capable of being complicated. You can't describe something in such a way that you finished with it, and there's no other possible description, and there's no other possible angle. So the rabbis start out by saying, yes, this is a ladder. Yes, there are angels. Yes, Jacob has a dream. But that's clearly not enough. So what else could the ladder be? And now you've moved slightly into drash, because the ladder could represent something else. Then you use the words of two simple words, actually, just yifgad b'makom, and you use those words to move into the realm of interpretation, because you've got to assume that anybody coming to the text would not think Sinai or the temple, right? And you know you're in drash when you say no simple reader would ever come to Sinai or the temple, right? From this, having said that, let's go on. Now we want to go to Remez. I'm going to skip several pages of Drash, and we're going to go to Remez. What does this hint at? He gives, by the way, some examples of what remes means. The way he defines remes is that, let's see. Well, as I said at the beginning, I'll give you the way remes seems at first glance to be both paradoxical and trite. The paradoxical aspect is because it appears to invert the hermeneutical process and turn the act of interpretation into a self-fulfilling event. There you go. So I don't think anything more needs to be added to that, do you? But the point is that remes is the something that you get a hint of that isn't spelled out. Okay, and it's not, so I'll give you, it will be more helpful. He gives the example of, I'll keep my eye on you connotes care and not necessarily sight. Or take my hand if you need to indicates emotional support, not physical clasping, right? Remes is, it hints something beyond the words that you can understand that is a common, so if nitzav is used with God being set on the stairway, the verb elsewhere means firmness and permanence. He reasonably supposes that the dream refers to God as a being who is stable, permanent, and constant. Right? That's the hint that the text is giving you by saying, by using that word. In other words, it's not a fully elaborated interpretation of everything in the story refers to Mount Sinai. It's rather some hint of what's really going on here. The interpretation, the stairway might be gradations of knowledge. And so what Jacob is doing is he's learning more and more and more about the world beyond. And then we come to Sod, which is the last one. And then I'll recap everything. Sod is really, he has a long thing about Sod. Okay, Jacob left Beersheba and went to Haran. So the journey is Jacob's quest towards wholeness. All right? He was a favorite child of his mother and received the blessing of bounty from his father. This was a sense of fullness, or sova, that filled the well of his life. But in order to be spiritually whole, he needed to know about other dimensions of being. And so he didn't leave Beersheba for Haran, not in the mystical understanding. He left the well of sevenfold bounty, Be'er Sova, Beersheba, Sheva means seven. He left the well of sevenfold bounty and entered the realm of the Achra, the realm of the lack of even, the realm of lack and even anger. Haran, Haron, anger. Okay? So Jacob leaves bounty and enters anger by going from Beersheba to Haran. That meant he had to relate to the earth in a new way. He lies down on the ground, and in so doing, the truth is revealed to him in a vision. He now perceives the dual aspects of being, material and spiritual, not as two distinct elements, but as points on one spectrum. God is above this. The whole truth is God's all being. But this is no external or heavenly truth. It's the truth of the interconnections of all aspects of being, and Jacob can ascend or descend through divine or angelic aspects of his own being with increased or decreased levels of consciousness as he goes about his life. This is the mystical interpretation. What's going on is going on in Jacob's soul. He's learning that spiritual and material aren't two separate opposite aspects. They're part of a continuum. And they all get united in God, and that's why he had to leave plentifulness, bounty, home, come to a place of emptiness and longing to learn that lesson. Not only this, but the ladder of the harmonic scales of being, which is interconnected, is within Jacob himself, because he's a microcosm, if only he would know it, right? Man is the measure of all things, was what the Renaissance philosopher said, and Judaism teaches the same thing, right? Everything is in you. Good and bad, right? Eternity and physicality, it's all in you, and it's especially in Jacob. How do we know this? Because it says the angels, as we noted before, but now we see it differently. Verse 12, it says, he dreamt the stairway and was set on the ground, and the angels of God were going up and down, bow, on it. What could it, bow also mean? On him. So the angels of God were going up and down on Jacob. There was a ladder, but they were traveling on Jacob. In other words, inside himself, his soul was making this journey. You can confirm this further because the stairway of spiritual wisdom, Jacob could ascend through aspects and modalities of being, and it has its top, Rosho, in heaven. That's what it says, right? But Rosh is also head. So we're still talking about Jacob's body, not only talking about the ladder. Certainly we can I just said that. It's linked to spirit. It's not easily comprehensible, all of this, even when portrayed in a vision. And the ascents and descents of the angels suggest that even Jacob will struggle repeatedly for inner balance during his lifetime. But the vision concludes with God's word of promise, suggesting that though this journey will be in and out of different realms, the truth of the unified whole of being will be with Jacob, like a sign of remembrance between his eyes. Though through each point in the world, one can touch something of the mysteries that pervade being. The passageways are everywhere. If one opens the estimations of one's heart, shiure liba, these being the gates of spiritual imagination and consciousness. Okay, so those are four different levels of looking at the ladder. And as you can see, Fishbane chooses the ladder because it's very open to mystical and midrashic interpretations. And one of the reasons that it is that it is, as I said before, the only uninterpreted dream in the Bible. That means that it's fair, you know, it's going to be harder to interpret Pharaoh's dream because Joseph already tells us what it means. But we don't know what Jacob's dream means, and it's clearly a pivotal point, and it is unexpected by Jacob. So all of that means that it's a good place to look at the different levels of interpretation. Let me just review them for a second. The pshat, the simple meaning, tries to understand what a ladder is, why Jacob goes there, and even maybe the way in which that word is used elsewhere that might mean that this is prayer. Then drash starts to see how those same words are used in complicated ways in other parts of the Bible and makes a story out of it, right? The story of Jacob and the ladder is really the story of the priests in the temple, or it's the story of Aaron and Moses going up the mountain, or we've made a zillion drashot in this class, right? Constantly we talk about, well, maybe when Isaac said this, he really meant that, or when Jacob did this, he really meant to do that, because don't you notice the word is phrased this way and it's not phrased that way? That's all drash, and you can see how the simple meaning and the drash are very hard to separate sometimes. Because when you say to somebody, really, we have to get together for lunch, and that person walks away and says, what that means is, I don't want to see you, right? And you say that's really what they meant, so is that pshat or drash? Sometimes it's one, sometimes it's just a mistake, but sometimes it's really, you know, when someone says, how are you, and you say, fine, does that mean I'm really fine, or does it mean I don't want to answer the question any more than say I'm fine? Or does it even mean I understood your question to be a formal question and not a real question? I mean, all those things are, and they're sort of somewhere in between pshat and drash. So the same here. When it says Jacob came to the place, does it mean the temple? Well, I think we can all agree that when this was written, that the author did not intend us to automatically think of the temple and Moses and Aaron, but certainly left open the possibility for drash. I was just thinking, when I said the author, I was just thinking, something occurred to me that happened years, when I published my first book, which was now 50, more than that, almost 20 years ago. And I went back, I was at a yeshiva in Harrisburg as a kid. I left after fifth grade, okay? So, because I moved to Philadelphia. And my father called me one day, and I was going back in Harrisburg, I was going to speak at some event. And my father called me one day, and he said, Rabbi Silver, his name is on the yeshiva now. He was the headmaster of the yeshiva, and I don't think I ever said a single word to Rabbi. I mean, we were all scared of Rabbi Silver because he was Rabbi, not because he was mean, but he was Rabbi Silver. So Rabbi Silver, he said, read your book and wants to talk to you about it. I said, how did Rabbi Silver get my book? My father said, I sent it to him. So when we went to Harrisburg, I was there with my brother, with my older brother, Paul. And we came to Rabbi Silver's house. And Paul at the time, I was not yet married, Paul was married, and we came with Paul's wife. And Rabbi Silver said, he welcomed us in, he sat us down in the living room, and he said to my sister-in-law, he said, I hope you'll forgive me, I'm a very traditional person. I wonder if you would go with my wife to the next room and you can sit and have tea and talk while the three of us talk here. So she did, very nicely. And we sat there, and he said to me, David, I enjoyed and I appreciated your book. He says, but I can't recommend it. I said, fair, and why? He said, because on page whatever, I don't know what page it was, He said, you wrote the author of Deuteronomy, and you did not capitalize the A.
Oh.
How about that? So I said, Rabbi Silver, I'm glad you told me, and for the paperback edition, I'm going to capitalize the A. Because why not? I mean, what do you have to lose in capitalizing an A? And so I did. When the paperback came out, the A, you will discover, if you ever see the book, is capitalized. And so when I said the author, it just, what's that? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, right. I don't know. He recommended the paperback. But it was just, it was quite remarkable. And it shows you how carefully, right, people look for the crucial, or at least he did, but he was a remarkable guy. Not Abba Hillel Silver. No, it was David Silver, Harrisburg. Yes. Hold on one second. Let me just finish this up and then I'll take questions. Then the sod is the things that it hints about what's going on here that we don't talk about. And there, it's not necessarily philosophical. It's often the emotional undercurrent of it, although not always. And it's just hinted at. It isn't explicated. So, for example, there is a sod in the fact that Jacob lies down and puts rocks under his head. There is a suggestion, perhaps, of the discomfort and the hardship that he's going to undergo in future years, right? That's a sort of hint that he has to put rocks under his head, that it says he put rocks under his head. And then there is the mystical interpretation about the angels moving up and down Jacob instead of moving up and down the ladder. And all four of those levels get applied to all. Now, there are more elaborate interpretive tools. And in fact, we see the 12 laws. If you ever go to the morning minyan, you'll see that we recite the 12 laws of Rabbi Yishmael, which are ways of interpreting the Talmud and the Torah too. But these are four basic levels of Torah interpretation that every verse is subjected to at one time or another. Okay, I'll stop there and let's take questions. Don. Yes. Another day. We have before. I've talked about it before in the class, but I'm not going to do it today. About who wrote the Bible. That's a long and long and complicated question. Deserves more than a quick remark at the end of the class. Yeah.
How did the four levels manifest themselves among the different strains of Judaism, Orthodox, conservative?
I don't think that they do particularly manifest themselves. I mean, I would just say that some take them more literally than others, but they're not, they don't have different ways of doing them, except the pshat. The one way that you'll get a difference in pshat, which is where you, let me put it this way. When I said the first part, that is, for example, people who are not literal believers in Kabbalah will understand mysticism metaphorically instead of literally. They don't really believe that Jacob traveled in supernal realms, but psychologically he did, or something like that. And the same thing with the Midrash. There are a lot of people who take Midrash quite literally and say, when they say, for example, that Abraham sought to sacrifice Isaac, Isaac went to study at the yeshiva of Shem Ve'ever, they mean that literally. Isaac went to study at a yeshiva, right? And if you say yeshivas weren't born for well over 1,000 years, probably more, they'll just see that as, apikorsut, that you don't actually believe the way you should. So one thing is the literalness with which you take midrashim. But the other part is that when it comes to the pshat, there's something that non-literalist or non-literalist readers will use, and that's a lot of comparative material. You can't get a PhD in Bible in any university outside of an Orthodox university if you can't understand the cognate languages. Sumerian, Akkadian. You have to be able to, because you can't know what ancient Hebrew means unless you know what the languages around it means. But if you think Hebrew is the original language, then those languages might be helpful in illuminating something by confirming what the traditional commentator said. But if they contradict what the commentator said, then they're just wrong and to be disregarded. So in that sense, the pshat is a different field for modern scholars than it is for traditional scholars. And the way, by the way, which goes back to Don's question before, one of the ways that you see that is a modern scholar will tell you that one of the ways that he decides that the Torah was written by human beings is that it shows the historical development of the Hebrew. That what's written at one phrase is an earlier phrase of Hebrew than what's written in the very next chapter. I'm not talking about other books. I'm talking about the next chapter, right? And so for a modern scholar of Hebrew, it's like reading Chaucer and Hemingway next to each other. It's clear that these are two different ages of writing, right? But for a classical scholar, it all melds together. And the way it melds together is through Midrash. It may look like an earlier phrase, but it's just an allusion to something that's later. So that's a big difference between the way moderns and classical scholars study the Torah. Yeah?
I was wondering if you knew the gospel song, We Are Crying in Jacob's Ladder. Because
I don't. No.
That seems to me that when I first had a hard time about the way we were talking about this in sort of a more literal way, they took that song, or we took the song if we were in social action, We Are Climbing Jacob's Ladder, and that's the dream of Martin Luther King. It's a whole, really, it's like God working through history, and the blacks taking this, thinking they were the ones that are climbing, or we who were working for social justice, climbing the ladder from slavery to freedom. Mm-hmm. And it's such a...
Well, yeah, the ladder metaphor is a very powerful one, a very powerful one, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've never heard it, but it makes sense. It does make sense. I don't know if that's, I don't know where they originate. It's an interesting question. So the question was whether the four levels of interpretation, he's heard of them referred to as the four rungs of a ladder. Yeah.
What critics of the Kabbalah say that this kind of interpretation, we do everything after the fact. It's very easy to have one story here, one story there, and somehow weave it together and connect them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not only criticism of the Kabbalah, that's criticism of people, for example, who find patterns in the Torah and things like that. The question is less whether you can find a pattern in something you already have. If you give me Joyce's Ulysses, I'll find you lots of patterns. The question is whether you can anticipate something that doesn't exist yet. You want to find me World War II in the Torah? I'm not impressed. If you tell me when World War III starts and you're right, I'll be depressed, but I'll be impressed too. So it's the predictive capacity of these things that is, humans are pattern-finding creatures. We find animals in clouds and we find patterns in the Torah, but unless you can find a pattern that lets you know that you couldn't have known it already, I think that it's, and by the way, if you really are interested in the Torah codes and you want to know why scholars reject them, there's a very, I hope that the website still exists, Jeffrey Tigay, T-I-G-A-Y, who's a scholar of Bible at the University of Pennsylvania, has a long and very clear explanation about why the Torah codes are illegitimate. So you just Google Torah codes Tigay, and I'm guessing that you'll come up with the site. But that's a subject for another time. Yeah.
The next sentence is, and he saw this thing. So it seems to me that the fact it's not interpreted suggests that it was a dream. And he dreamed, and then.
Right, well, there is that. I mean, the rabbis actually have that interpretation too, which is. Right, that maybe he saw this, he had a dream, and then, remember, we talked about that very briefly, but then he actually saw this that wasn't a dream. So I would say, on the one hand, the rabbis say in the Talmud that a dream uninterpreted is like a letter unopened. On the other hand, yes, there is some value in just letting things be. We're not very good at that. And I would say in particular, since every tradition has a bias, right? That is, every message that exists in almost every tradition exists in other traditions too, right? When someone says this is the teaching of Buddhism, you can always find a Hasidic rabbi who said the same thing, and vice versa. But traditions have emphases, right? The difference in traditions tends not to be that one of them discovered a message that the other one never dreamed of, but rather that they have differences in emphases. And I would argue that the emphasis of the Jewish tradition is in restlessness and seeking and interpretation, as opposed to just letting something be. We're not really good at the just letting something be. You know, I would say, along with get your elbows off the table, the most common parental complaint in our house was, can you just leave it alone, right? And the answer was almost always no. We couldn't leave it alone. We were like, you know, dogs worrying a bone. So to ask the rabbis to say, okay, it's a dream, we're just gonna let it be, is to make them into Buddhist monks. And they I don't think they can do it. I can't do it. I don't think they can do it. So, but it's a noble aspiration. I agree. I grant you. Yeah.
Freud had a comment. Sometimes a cigar is just
a cigar. Just a cigar. Right, exactly. Yes, Freud did say that. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. The only thing that I would say is that the rabbis assumed that God put infinite meaning in every word of the Torah, and it was our task to discover it. So if it's our task, then you can't just leave it alone. It's your task. It's a sacred task. It's the human task. It's the holy task, and we will continue that task next week. Thanks.